Tell you how much I appreciate the Shenandoah congregation through the years. Of course, my relationship with this congregation began when I was a lowly preacher student, and this was one of the congregations that helped sponsor me, and I really do appreciate the support that I've received through the years through prayers and finance and everything. And I'll never forget the first time that my wife and I came down. We were 19 years old, and we were driving a little gray S10 pickup. We'd been married about a year, and we came to the church building here, and we met with the secretary, Brother Wayne Holmes, who was also serving as an elder at the time. And I think we ate at the Pink Sombrero or the Sombrero Rosa or something like that, and he took us out for some Mexican food. And last night I went out for some Mexican food, and it didn't sit well with me. So I'm a little bit older, and you know what they say, as you get a little older, your body changes. And so, I'll go ahead and get this over with now. Since, okay. Yeah, that's much better. You know, the funny thing is I wear them all the time, BJ. I have to wear glasses all the time. But I just had to poke a little fun at you there. It's nothing to do with your age either, because I'm younger than you. And but that's okay. I also want to tell you how much I appreciate you coming out this morning. It takes a lot to drag yourself out of bed early on a Saturday morning when it's rainy and foggy, and you think, well, there's not much going on this morning. Just Sam Dillbeck, come on. You know, so. But I do appreciate you being here, and that means a lot to me. Her name was Hannah Mack. She was 6 years old when a man raped her and hung her in the family garage to die. We hear stories like that about those who are predators on children, predators on other human beings, and we become angry, and rightfully so. Our sensibilities get offended. We think about how could it possibly be that God would allow such evil to exist in this world? And we get angry. There was a little girl in our congregation, one of the best friends of this little girl that was killed. After seeing a news report on the little girl, having not seen her for a few days at school, she told her mommy, "I want to die so I can go see Hannah too." When we make such evil mistakes in this world and decisions, we mess up our society. And we become angry about it. And rightfully so. In fact, you know, I can't tell you how many times I heard someone say, if I just had one room or 1 hour in a room alone with that person. We say hell is not hot enough, nor eternity long enough for the justice that we demand over such egregious acts. It is amazing to me what people can devise, or what sort of evil that people can devise of their own lives and ruin a peaceful society, ruin a nation that is trying to be righteous. And we start to ask that question, God, how long will you allow evil to exist? You know, it's been a question that has been asked through the ages. David, King David asked the question. Habakkuk asked the question. Jeremiah, you remember Jeremiah said, God, how is it that you have planted the wicked and they prosper? They bring forth fruit. They continue to live. And oh, what I wouldn't have given for God to answer him. Not just Jeremiah, but to answer the atheists and the skeptics down through the ages. But instead, you'll recall, he said, Jeremiah, if running with the footmen has caused you to be wearied, what are you going to do when the horses come? If you can't get over this one small problem that you see and understand it, when the big theological great questions come, how are you going to survive? Because sometimes we may not have all the answers. We can talk about the free moral agency of man, and we can talk about how evil is introduced by the choice of man and not by the direction of God. We can make all of those arguments, and I think they're sound arguments, but I think in the end we finally have to say, you know, there's some things that we may not fully understand until we walk the heavenly realm. I think that's what God was telling Jeremiah. Jeremiah, there's going to be some things that you don't understand. And so we come to Psalm 37, and we're going to ask ourselves the question, how do we get through life then knowing that evil exists? How are we going to face the world each and every morning, knowing that someone might go into another school and shoot 15 or 20 people? How do we get up every morning knowing that the mall is no longer a safe place? How do we get up every day knowing that there's some little 6-year-old girl somewhere that is being preyed upon by a pedophile and her life cut short? And the answer is actually given to us in Psalm 37. And it comes down to one word: trust. That's it. Trust. Trust that God's grand scheme and grand design is going to prevail in the end. In fact, what I know about trust is that it is the remedy for all the troubles and trials and turmoil of this life. Trusting in God is the answer to all things. Now, we're going to look at Psalm 37. We're going to divide it into three, I think, that are fairly natural divisions. There's a lot of repetition. Anytime you come to a Psalm of David, David repeats many of his themes, like the deliverance of God, that God protects us, that God loves us and has mercy upon us, that He is our refuge and our strength. All of these themes we find throughout the book of Psalms in David's Psalms, and we're going to find them here in chapter 37 as well. Not only do we see that they're repeated throughout his Psalms, but we see that these very same themes are repeated throughout the Psalm, Psalm 37. In other words, we're going to see deliverance more than once. We're going to see strength more than once. We will see the providence of God on more than one occasion in these 40 verses. But as we look through them, I hope that you will gain a trust in God. Let's begin in verses 1 through 11, and we see, number 1, that we trust God as our refuge. Now, refuge was a hiding place. It was a shelter from the storm. And especially the shelter from the storms of life. God is the place where we go to find shelter from all the things that would come against us. Now, I see in these 11 verses, though, that there is a 6-step process to walking into the shelter of God, to stepping under God's shelter. And the first one is, we've got to release our worries. Notice verses 1 and 2. Fret not yourselves because of evildoers. Be not envious of wrongdoers, for they will soon fade like the grass and wither like the green herb. We must release our worries. One of the things that keeps us from truly trusting in God is that we are fretting over all the little things in life. We fret over things in our own personal lives. Will I have enough money to pay the mortgage? Will I have a job whenever they start doing the layoffs? Will I be able to pass this test and the next test in school? We have all of these little worries in our own lives. If you have children, you know that you have even more worries and anxieties. Will they grow up and be a Christian? One of the greatest anxieties we might feel is the pull of our own children and how they've got to face a world that, as we look at it, we say, man, it wasn't that bad when I was a kid. Man, here's what my kids have to face. Then there's all the things around us in a grander scale. The evil and the wickedness. There's so many things to worry about, and yet Jesus tells us in Matthew 6:34, what man of you, being anxious over your height, can add one cubit to your height? How you can't make yourself grow. Worrying doesn't fix the problem. David tells us, fret not, release the worries. Have you ever met someone who was so worried that they didn't seem to function in life very well? I mean, there are people who have anxieties, and then there's people who's got some anxieties. Peter says, cast your cares on Him, for He cares for you. 1 Peter 5:7. It is a true proverb when we say that God does not want us to be anxious. We are to be anxious for nothing, we're told. In Philippians 4:6, in the book, I have Colossians 4:6, if you want to make that correction. We may find a whole bunch of corrections. that should be Philippians 4:6 instead of Colossians 4:6 in the book. The second step into the refuge of God is found in verse 3 and 4, though. He says, trust in the Lord and to do good. Dwell in the land and befriend faithfulness. The second step is to trust in God for care and food. And where does the food come from? Feed on faithfulness, the King James has. The ESV that I'm using says, befriend faithfulness. The word faithfulness is also properly translated as truth. In other words, what he's telling us to do is to trust in the Lord, do good, dwell in the land, and what? And feed upon the truth of God. It's not just the concept of, you know, that we need to feast on being faithful, but we need to feast on the truth of God. You want to find shelter and comfort in the beneath the wings of the Father? Then, brethren, we need to start trusting in God to feed us. And not just feast on anything, but feast on the truth of His Word. Verse 4, step number 3, he says, delight yourself in the Lord, and He will give you the desires of your heart. There's an old saying that says, if you do what you love for a living, you'll never have to work a day in your life. That's pretty good, isn't it? Kind of the same thing here. Delight yourself in the Lord, and the Lord will give you all the desires of your heart. In other words, if what makes you happy are the things that God gives you, then you will always be happy. If what makes you happy are the things that the world gives you, then guess what? You will always be frustrated. You will never be happy. God says that we need to delight ourselves in Him. And He will give us all the things that we desire. You know, too many people look at the life of Christianity as a life of limitations. Well, if I become a Christian, I can't do that. And if I become a Christian, I can't do that. And we start listing all the things we cannot do because a lot of people want to engage in a season of sin, even though that season is so short, Hebrews 11:25. But if we will find delight in such things as the prosperity of God, in the providence of God, in the pattern which God has given to us. I love Isaiah 58:13-14, where he talks about how they were to keep the Sabbath day and enjoy keeping the law of God. If you will delight in keeping the law of God, then you will always be happy. Unless you step outside the law of God. It's interesting, this word delight comes from or a derivative of being delicate. And it was in reference to how those would, after you got so much money, you would start living a delicate life. You know, your hands would soften, the calluses would go away, you know, because you didn't have to do hard manual work anymore. You know, you sit back in your house and you start feasting on the delicacies of life, and everything is very fragile, it seems. And then it came to be known as being delighting or delighting in those things. But I love this concept of being delicate. You know, God created us, brethren, delicate. What do I mean by that? I mean, He created us in a way that we have to depend on Him to make it through life. We're delicate creatures. Oh, I know we're rugged and hardy and we can face the wilderness and all that. But essentially, we are delicate in the sight of God. We are fragile in the sight of God. Especially compared to Him. I mean, we're talking about the Creator of the universe. He who is from everlasting to everlasting. The Alpha and the Omega. And what are we but a speck, a dot in time. You see how fragile we are, how delicate we are. And so we delight ourselves in what God has given to us. So step 4, verse 5. Commit your way to the Lord. Trust in Him and He will act. He will bring forth your righteousness as the light and your justice as the noonday. The word commit here has the concept of rolling. He's used it in several places in the Old Testament about rolling your burden on Him, committing your ways to Him. The fourth step to finding refuge in God is bending your will to His will. Roll your will into His will. Commit your ways to Him. If God is in control of our lives, brethren, then we can truly find a refuge from the Creator of the universe, a protection from Him. And then notice what He says, He will bring forth your righteousness as light. The other day I was sitting at my desk, my computer desk, you know, and I had sitting there a CD repair kit. I don't know if you've ever seen one of these. It's got a little wheel on it, and you crank it around, and it's got a very, like, fine strip of sandpaper, and it and it, you know, sands off or buffs that CD again and takes any scratches out. Well, I'm sitting there, and you kind of got to know me a little bit in that, if, you know, my hands have got to be doing something. So I'm reading online, and I start doing that wheel, and I think, well, you know, I'll stick my fingernail on there. So I stick my thumbnail on it, and I tell you what, it's still shining. I don't know. I may blind you if I do this, but that thing's still shining. Just sit there and buffs it to a sheen. And I said, Julie, you got to see this. And so I sat her down and I did all of her fingers on my little CD repair kit. You know, buffed them all out to a nice shine. That's kind of what God is saying here. If we will commit our way to Him, if we'll give our life to Him, guess what He's going to do? He's going to buff it to a nice shine. He's going to make it shine like the noonday so that everyone will see the righteousness that God has instilled in us. In verse 7, he says, "Be still before the Lord and wait patiently for Him. Fret not yourself over the one who prospers in his ways, the one man, or over the man who carries out evil devices." Step number 5 in stepping into the refuge of God is to grow silent. Be still. Psalm 46 verse 10 tells us to be still and know that I am the Lord. In 1 Kings 19, you'll recall that Elijah's up on the mountain and he sees the earthquake and the wind and the fire and all these things. And remember, God was not in those. And then God speaks to him what? Out of a still, small voice. Be still. Or grow quiet. Why in the world would he tell us that we need to grow quiet? Because the world around us is a bunch of noise. There is so much. How many times, brethren, have you preached from the pulpit that people who are engaged in all the soccer games and all the little league games and all the after school activities, they are so busy in their lives they can't hear God. The din of noise around us from the world will drown out the voice of God as He speaks to us. Because we no longer find time for prayer. We no longer find time for study. We no longer find time for meditation. And when we lose those things, we lose God. And so the psalmist says, be still. Grow quiet. I cannot help but see, at least in part, he is talking about meditation. You know, HD was talking about meditating last night and how we have one of the greatest jobs because we get to sit and meditate all day long. But you know, the fact is, we all have time for meditation. Every single one of us. Because God gave us all an equal amount of time. We all have 24 hours in a day. We all have work to do. We all have a choice to make. I will carve out this amount of time for my meditation. You know, why meditation is such a lost art in Christianity, I will never know. It is the discipline of the blessed person from Psalm 1 and verse 2, right? In His law does he meditate day and night. Psalm 119 verse 97 tells us that it is the pastime of the righteous king. Those who are going to be righteous will meditate in His law day and night. Those who are leading the nation, Joshua 1 verse 7 and 8. It is, in fact, 1 Timothy 4:15, the strength of the gospel preacher. Meditation needs to be so important in our lives. As the world gets louder, we need to grow quieter so that we can hear the voice of God. And then finally, step number 6, verse 8 and 9 says, "Refrain from anger and forsake wrath. Fret not yourself. It tends only to evil. For evildoers shall be cut off, but those who wait for the Lord shall inherit the land." Instead of fretting over what the evildoers are doing, becoming angry at how they seem to be prospering, and joining them because of our anger, we need to wait on the Lord to deal with the unrighteous. We need to wait on the Lord to handle the injustices of life. We need to wait on Him and trust that He will do exactly what He has promised. Fret not yourself. It only tends to evil. Unrighteous anger. We know that there's a righteous indignation. We know that we can be angry and sin not, Ephesians 4:26. But unrighteous anger, that which tends to evil, is usually fueled by jealousy and self-pity. And so he tells us, refrain from anger and forsake wrath. In other words, if we're going to find refuge in God, we need to stop being angry at all the things of the world that make us so angry. Especially those things that are fueled by self-pity and jealousy. Angry because my neighbor got a better lawnmower than I did. Angry because his house has got a new coat of paint on it and I can't afford to paint my house yet. Angry because he has a better job. He doesn't have to get up till 10 o'clock in the morning. He gets home at 3 and he makes twice as much as I do. Self-pity and jealousy. He says you've got to refrain from anger. Verse 10 and 11 then, he kind of summarizes this section about God being our refuge. In just a little while, the wicked will be no more. Though you look carefully at his place, he will not be there. In other words, God's taken him out. God will deal with the evil person, but the meek shall inherit the land. Quoted by Jesus in Matthew 5 and verse 5, the meek shall inherit the land or the earth. As far as theological words go, this is one of the most used words in the Bible, in the Old Testament, land or earth. In this case, we've seen it already twice in this psalm, verse 3 and verse 9. We'll see it again at least three more times. I truly believe that he is talking about the heavenly realm. In this case, Jesus, of course, applies it that way about the meek having or being able to inherit the earth in Matthew 5 and verse 5. And it just makes sense as we consider that God or the Lord is our shepherd. David, of course, makes that great statement in Psalm 23 that the Lord is our shepherd. And what does the shepherd do? He leads them in the paths of righteousness to the green pasture and feeds them. But ultimately, he's looking at how God is going to eventually shepherd us into heaven, isn't he? Isn't he looking forward to that great future realm? And notice what he says in verse 3. Trust in the Lord, do good, and dwell in the land. What land? The land of heaven. If we will trust God and do good, we'll dwell in heaven. Evildoers shall be cut off, verse 9, but those who wait on the Lord shall inherit the land, that heavenly land, if we will trust in Him. And then here again, the meek shall inherit the land and delight themselves in abundant peace. Abundant peace. Peace, that inward calm amid an outward turmoil. That passes all understanding, Philippians 4 and verse 7. The type of peace that we truly desire. So we need to trust in God as our refuge. Number two, we need to trust in God as our judge. Verses 12 through 22. And we're going to have to speed up a little bit here. The wicked plot. He begins in this section where, in the first section, he's identifying the fact that the wicked are going to be cut off. In this section, he deals with the actual sin that the wicked are doing. He identifies several things that they are doing against God and against the righteous, and therefore reiterates the fact that they are going to be cut off by the justice of God. And so we see God in the role of a judge, and we trust that the decisions he make will be fair, will be equitable, and be according to his will, or according to the word that he has delivered to us. In other words, God is not going to change his mind about us, or about who's going to go to heaven in the later days. He's already made up his mind. He's already set the standard. All we have to do is live up to it. And so he becomes our judge. Notice, the wicked plots against the righteous, gnashes his teeth at him. But the Lord laughs at the wicked, for he sees that his day is coming. You see two people looking at the same future. You see the wicked, they're looking down the road at their own future. And they're gnashing their teeth. I always think of Snidely Whiplash, you know, from the Dudley Do-Right cartoons, you know. And he's, you know, that's the wicked plotting against the righteous. This big toothy grin as he gnashes his teeth at them. And he says, oh, my future's going to be good. I'm going to take out these righteous people. I'm going to take their money. I'm going to live high on the hog. So he's looking down the road at his own future. And then what does God do? God looks down the road at his future too, but one of them's right and one of them's wrong. And I assure you, God's the right one here. He noticed what he says, and God laughs at him. You know, as he's I'm going to get those righteous, God laughs at this man. Have you ever seen the bumper sticker that says, if you ever want to make God laugh, tell him your plans? Especially is that true of those who are unrighteous. God laughs at him because God sees that his day is coming. God sees. So the first sin that he identifies here is that the wicked plot against the righteous. In verse 14, he progresses from plan to action, doesn't he? The wicked draw the sword and bend their bows to bring down the poor and the needy, to slay those who are upright in the way. Their sword, he says, shall enter into their own hearts, and their bows shall be broken. In other words, they not only are they planning or devising to go against the wicked or against the righteous, but now they have drawn sword. They have strung their bow. They're ready to go to war. They are taking action on their plan. It's kind of strange. You know, those who are righteous, we often plan to do what's good and then we never take action on our plan. But here's the wicked. They plan to do evil and they're going to take action. They're going to do exactly what they said they'd do. Now, here is one of those verses that's the height of irony. As they draw their sword to slay the upright and the poor and the needy, their own sword is used to destroy them. It's kind of like Haman's gallows. As soon as I read, that's the first thing I thought of. Haman's gallows. Here's Haman who's angry with Mordecai. He says, I'm going to hang that man because he refused to bow down and show proper respect for me. So he builds these great gallows. And in the end, who swung from the gallows? But Haman himself. He draws the sword, and yet it's his own sword that will slay him. Jesus said in Matthew 26, in verse 52, that all who live by the sword will what? Die by the sword. True irony. Verse 16-17. Better is the little that the righteous has than the abundance of many wicked. In other words, here's a man who is greedy, who is hoarding money. Notice the imagery in verse 17. The arms of the wicked shall be broken, but the Lord upholds the righteous. And we see one of these, the whole instance of this psalm is some sort of parallelism. But here's that synonymous parallelism. The arms of the arms of the wicked shall be broken. Well, what is the wicked doing? I kind of have this picture of Scrooge McDuck. You know, he's got his arms out and he's raking in the wealth, you know, and he's hoarding and he's hugging onto all of his riches. Oh, this is nice. This is great. But what's going to happen? It says his arms will be broken. He will become powerless to hold on to the wealth, the abundance that he has, see? And while he is trying to uphold his wealth right now, and his arms will be broken, the converse of that is that the Lord is going to uphold the righteous. And I'll tell you this, God's arms won't break. God will continue to uphold the righteous. The Lord knows the day of the blameless, verse 18, and their heritage will remain forever. God will uphold those who are righteous. They are not put to shame in evil times, and in the days of famine, they have abundance. They have true abundance. Notice, in the days of famine, we're living at a time, or David is living in a time when, there's not a Walmart on every other corner. You know, abundance was, the ability to have fields and agriculture and food at all times. But he says, even in the midst of famine, when that which measures wealth is gone, the righteous still has abundance. Because he has God. You know, it's the same way today. We could lose absolutely everything and still have God and live in abundance. But the wicked, he says, they will perish. The enemies of the Lord are like the glories of the pastures. They vanish. Like smoke, they vanish. He uses two pictures here of the demise of the wicked. The glories of the pasture. You go out and you can imagine seeing the rolling fields, maybe of wheat. And you see that the wheat coming to ripening in the field, and you think, man, that's going to yield a lot of grain. There's a lot of people will be fed by that grain, by the glory of that pasture. But you know what happens after it's harvested and the winter sets in? All the green fades away and the grass withers, right? So that's the way the wicked are. They're going to wither. He's already mentioned it all the way back in verse 2. They will soon fade like grass and wither like the green herb. So he says in verse 20, the glories of the pasture, they will vanish. Smoke. You know, if you ever stand around a campfire and the smoke is just thick and choking, you look up a little ways and what does it do? It kind of dissipates in the air and vanishes away. That's the life of the wicked. Verse 21, the wicked borrows but does not pay back. A lot of commentators say that this is more about a condition. That, you know, once he borrows, he spends it all and he can't pay it back. That may be true. We definitely live in a society that is where normal is broke, right? We live in a society where people are so far in debt they can't do what they promised to do. But I see it also more as character, because it says the righteous is generous and gives. The righteous person is going to give to those who are in need. In fact, give to his own hurt, like the widow casting her two mites in Mark chapter 12. The Macedonians who gave out of deep poverty, 2 Corinthians 8, 1 and 2. Righteous people give to their own hurt, and as a result, they are blessed by the Lord. Luke 6, 38 tells us that as we give, it will be given back to us, right? Shaken together, pressed down, overflowing into the lap. For those blessed by the Lord shall inherit the land, but those who are cursed by Him shall be cut off. We've got to trust God as our judge, that He will bring about justice in this life. Number 3. Now we're really going to have to go fast. God is our provider, verses 23 through 33. The steps of the man are established by the Lord. He delights in His way. Verse 24, we'll look at it real quickly. He provides our support. The Lord upholds His hand. He will not fall headlong, or a headlong fall is a death fall. In other words, the righteous may fall at times, and some say, well, you know, that's into unrighteousness. It may be. It may just be that he's falling down and not able to, meet his daily requirements of things that he owes. Either way, the idea is that God will pick him up. God provides support. In verse 25, he says, I've been young, now I'm old. Tim Ayers commented on this. But God provides our sustenance. God is going to feed us the things that we need in this life if we will seek first His kingdom. Matthew 6, 33. Verses 27 and 28, God preserves or provides a preservation. He protects our soul and keeps it. But the key is that this is a two-part command. Turn away from evil and what? Do good. Brethren, we've got to do good. There's too many people who are trying to live a life of not doing evil, but they're not doing good either. Remember 1 John 3:10. By this we know that who are the children of God and who are the children of the devil. Whoever is not doing righteousness is the child of the devil. We have got to not just put away the evil, but we've got to put on the good. And then verse 30 and 31 says, the mouth of the righteous utters wisdom. He speaks justice. The law of God is in his heart. His steps do not slip. Now I wanted to get to this verse and spend a lot of time, but I'm not going to be able to spend as much time. But his heart, notice, the law of God is in his heart. Brethren, we've got to infuse our heart with the Word of God. We have got to put the Word in our heart, right? I put your Word have I hid in my heart that I might not sin against you, Psalm 119, verse 11. We've got to keep it in the heart. We've got to have it stay there or abide there, John 14, 23, because as it abides there, the Father abides there, the Son abides there, the Spirit abides there. And not only that, but God wrote His Word on the outside of man's heart, right? Oh, we see the infusion. We've got it in. We've got it staying in. We've got it written on the outside, Jeremiah 31, 31. And we even have it surrounded by the breastplate of righteousness from the Word of God, Ephesians 6 and verse 14. So that when we do all of these things, Mark 7, what will come out is righteousness. When our heart is infused by the Word of God. And then verse 33, He provides protection for us against the wickedness of those who are trying to bring our downfall. And then finally, and this is really fast, God must be trusted as our strength. Four keys to finding the strength of God. One, we've got to wait on God, verse 34. Number two, we've got to be humble before God, verse 35 and 36. Three, we've got to be upright before God, 37 and 38, and the 39 and 40, we've got to trust God. And 39 and 40 become kind of the summary to the whole psalm. The salvation of the righteous is from the Lord, not from ourselves. God's grace is the only power that can bridge the gap between my imperfections and heaven's perfection.